Want more stories in your life without adding to your TBR? That's where Audible comes in. I use it for the original novellas, the Plus catalog like Deanna Reborn's Veronica Speedwell series, and those audiobook sales that you can beat. Right now, Audible has a special offer for new and returning members. Click the link in the show notes to see what deal you'll get and start listening today. Welcome to the What to Read Next podcast. In this podcast, your host, Lori Amin, will interview published authors to chat about their work, journey to getting published, and their book recommendations. If you share a passion for books and always looking for your next read, then join us. Welcome to the What to Read Next podcast. Today we have an author interview, Sarah McLean. When I started reading historic romance, I knew I needed to pick up her books, and I have to tell you, the Bare Knuckle Bastard series gets better with each book. I can't wait to dive into her backlist. If you're a fan of the Romance podcast, you should check out Fated Mates podcast, which is Sarah's podcast with Jen Praga. Last week's episode for Fated Mates was an amazing interview with Joanna Shoup, and it was all about unusual historic romance, so it's perfect if you want to add new books to your TBR. Let's talk about this interview in the What to Read Next podcast. Well, I interviewed Sarah, and we chatted about her writing process, what it's like to write a historical romance, her latest book, During the Duke, and of course, a round of book recommendations. Now let's go to an interview. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the What to Read Next podcast.
Hi, Laura. Thanks so much for having me.
So happy to have you here. Just tell us a little about yourself.
I am a writer of historical romance novels and other things. I write columns about romance, and I write essays about romance and about feminism, and generally I'm pretty angry on Twitter right now all the time. So, you know, if that's your jam, if that's something you think you'd be interested in, someone who writes about kissing and like is also very angry on Twitter, that is me. That is my brand. My very like weird brand.
I love your brand.
It was an unexpected brand.
I have to tell you, you have kept me company on long walks over the quarantine. Thanks to your podcast. Like, I just listened to the episode and I just like, it's all good. Everything's going to be okay.
Well, thank you, Jen. And Jen and I are very happy that we could be there with you. Yes. And I didn't mention that, but I have a podcast myself. It's called Fated Mates. And we release every Wednesday. And our episodes are either deep dive reads of books that we think are really fabulous in romance, or a wide-ranging discussion of a trope in romance or a theme in romance. So if you're a romance lover, check us out. Fatedmates.net.
Yes, I love this. So when did you start reading romance? I'm always curious about this.
When I was far too young to be reading romance. I started reading romance when I was in middle school. Okay. I had an older sister who was a Harlequin book club subscriber. So she would get a box every month of 5 or 6 Harlequin contemporaries, category romances, and she would shove them under her bed because she was hiding them from my parents. And I would pull them out on the other side and read them. And I was maybe 12, mm-hmm. 11 or 12 when I read my first romance, which was actually not a Harlequin. It was Jude Devereaux's The Black Lion, which is super problematic, but also incredibly delicious still for me, because it just, you know, it installed my id. And then when I went to middle school, across the parking lot at middle school was the public library. And so, you know, after school, sometimes if I was staying late at school, I would walk over to the public library, and they kept all the romance novels in the dark, quite literally. The aisles of the library where the romance section was had always had the lights turned off. And so I was the kind of kid who was like, if the lights are turned off, that's definitely for me. And that's where I discovered romance. And that's where I discovered all of the romance novelists who have really, you know, talk about installing my id, but also who, without whom I would not write. I mean, they really did introduce me to the genre and make me love it.
So what inspired you to become a writer?
I've always kind of loved, well, I've always loved books. I've always loved publishing. I worked in publishing for a long time. And I had a friend who was in editorial at a children's publisher, and we were out one night, and Twilight was just happening. We had all read Twilight. And I said, you know, I feel like I could write one of these. and she was like, well, I dare you to write one. And I had just enough alcohol to go home and write the first chapter of my first book, which was great. I mean, not, the book wasn't great, but like the freedom of writing that book was great. I wrote it really fast. It was the fastest book I've ever written. And it was a YA romance, YA Regency, because I had grown up reading Regencies, and I was reading Regency, adult Regencies, like Lisa Kleypas and Julia Quinn and Eloisa James and, you know, Lorraine Heath, all through, you know, as an adult. But I was writing YA because I sort of felt like, well, I want to write YA is the thing you write right now. And I did. I wrote one, and I was very lucky to have it published. But then instantly I sort of knew, like, I was not long for the YA world, because I wanted to write sex in my books. So, and also I think YA is, it's really tricky. I'm very wedded to the happily ever after as a end post of the game, yeah, of the books. And so for me, YA can't deliver that the same way that adult romance can, because it's just not realistic. I mean, you're 17. You should not be getting married.
Yeah.
You're 17 and listening to this podcast. Don't get married.
Yeah. All right. So I had a question. So you write Regency. What's the type of research you do to get the time period right, the sense of feelings of you're in the 1800s and
look like? Well, I should say I started out writing Regency, but now I write Victorian for lots of reasons, but, you know, mainly because time is marching in my books and now Victoria is queen. But the research process is, you know, a lot of people ask about the research process and they expect that it's, you know, really intense and, you know, involves months and months of research. But the reality is that when you write historicals, especially when you are like me or many romance novelists who write historicals all in a specific time period, the research process actually gets easier and easier as you continue to write. And part of that is because you just have learned all the basics. So you don't have to spend that much time doing it. Also, most of us who write in this time period or write historicals in general are historians at heart. And so we read, you know, for me, I read a lot of, when I'm not reading romance novels, I'm reading nonfiction and usually about the empire, the British Empire in the 1830s and 40s. So, because that's what I'm writing right now. So I'm interested in it, right? So I'm reading about like gangs in London in the 1840s, because I'm working on a series right now that's about a girl gang in the 1830s. So there's all that. But also I think it's important to sort of point out that in my 11 years of writing historical romance, I've never come up with an idea that didn't have roots in history either before or after the idea. So to give you a sense of, you know, the ice, my current series, The Barenuckle Bastards, the last book of which comes out on the 30th of June. The first book, Wicked and the Wallflower, sort of sets up this criminal enterprise run by a kind of makeshift family, two brothers and a sister. And they are ice smugglers, meaning they smuggle goods that are heavily taxed or banned by the government of England into London on ships that actually appear to be shipping ice into London. When I had this idea, it was kind of not at all fully formed. I sort of was interested in the idea of, you know, I had like a three-year-old and she watched a lot of Frozen and I had this idea that was like, how do they get ice into warmer places.
Yeah.
Like London was a massive trade city. There's a lot of meat in London. There are a lot of vegetables in London. Like refrigeration had to have happened in the summer. How did that work? Mm-hmm. And then kind of instantly I started reading about ice, the ice trade. And I realized like it was completely plausible that, you know, a smuggling operation could operate under the radar via ice, because when the boats came up the Thames, the River Thames to London from Scandinavia, the ice had melted so much in the hold that they were actually sinking. The boats were like basically sinking as they came up the river. So the holds were full of water, full of ice. They were impossible to search because ice is very heavy and had to be moved very quickly. So like it made sense to me that a smuggling ring could exist in this way. Mm-hmm. And what's fascinating about that is I was really lucky in the sense that like very soon refrigeration is going to get sorted out. So a smuggling ring can't happen in ice ships, you know, after say 1850, but I just happened to be writing before then. So research wise, I often think that the idea comes first and the research follows, and pretty much nothing. Yeah. You know, everything new is old, you know, everything old is new again.
I love that. Yeah. Who are you writing? Do you follow an outline or do you see where the story leads you?
I do not outline, and it is a mistake. No one should write the way I write. I don't outline. I don't know anything about the book except for the ending. So if you're a romance reader, you know that the ending of a book is obviously a happily ever after. That's the covenant we have with readers as writers of romance. And what I know is but what comes immediately kind of before the happily ever after is what we call the low moment of the book, or the dark moment of the book. And that's the moment where as a reader, you think like these two are never going to end up together, right? Like this can't work. This relationship is doomed. And I know that moment, that doomed moment, I have to know it before I start a book, but I pretty much know nothing else. So, and I don't write out of order. So I have to start at the beginning. The way I describe it, and people who've heard me talk about my process before, I apologize because this is a repeat for you, but the way I often describe it is, imagine if you woke up one morning and you had to get to the grocery store, but all the roads you would ordinarily use to get to the grocery store are out of service. Like are blocked. So you know where you're going, but you can't get there.
Mm-hmm.
Or rather you have to figure out a new way to get there.
Yeah.
So that's my writing process and it's terrible.
Okay. So because you write series, so how do you organize yourself as a writer to keep track of all the characters, the series tickets, the locations?
I'm also pretty bad at that, I'll be honest. This is not a good podcast. I am pretty bad at that. My big joke is that I have the hero in the fourth book of my casino series was sorted out. I mean, I knew who the hero of the fourth book of my casino series was going to be from the first book of my casino series, but his name changes over the course of the books. He starts out as Dominic West or something, and then he ends up as Duncan West. And I mean, I don't have an excuse except to say I don't keep a series Bible. Everything's locked in my brain. And that's also a terrible way of doing it. what I would say is this, I have a really stellar team at HarperCollins. I'm very grateful for them. And the copy editor there has been with me for, I don't know, 6 or 7 books. And she often is the one who will flag a name and say, hey, this person I'm pretty sure was named something else 3 books ago. So there's that. But yeah, I mean, I propose when I start a book, I know, I mean, when I start I never conceive of a book as a one-off. I conceive of a book as part of a multi-book series always. Mm-hmm. And so, the problem is that sometimes a character will sort of rise up and you'll think, oh, I'm going to write a book about that person. Mm-hmm. And then it ends up being four books from now. Mm-hmm. And I also don't reread my own books because that way lies danger. So a lot of it. So there's a lot of flying by the seat of my pants that goes on over here.
This is so fascinating. I love hearing each author's process. And it's just fascinating to see, you know.
Yeah.
It's a big undertaking and then trying to figure out how to do it.
Yeah. I mean, I have a friend, my friend Nisha Sharma, who like could not be more different than me. I don't really understand how we're friends, but she, you know, plots everything out to the like to the nth degree. She knows the dates, the times, the weather. She keeps a series Bible about all of her characters. She writes contemporaries. I mean, like, she is, every piece of that book is sorted before she starts. Mm-hmm. And that is, it feels, that seems really magnificent.
Yeah.
I should try that, but I wouldn't. I'm the kind of person who buys a new notebook and is like, I have a new notebook. It's going to be amazing. I'm going to keep everything really organized. And then the notebook lasts like 3 days and then
yeah.
I'm back to literally like piles of post-it notes. So I don't know.
I feel you.
The important thing is that I get the words written, right?
Yep. And you put some books out. So so do you share your work along the way? Do you wait to complete a father story?
My editor sees the first 100 pages of my book always. That's my editor, Carrie Farron at HarperCollins at Avon. And she sees the first 100 pages because she and I both like to know that things are going in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And she taught me this. I've learned, you know, I think that a gift that is given to many authors who have great relationships with their editors is editorial experience when you're a debut. And from the very start, she has been really a writing teacher for me as well. And she told me in my first book, the first 100 pages are where if you get to page 100 as a reader and all the threads aren't laid out, all the plots aren't clear in the sense of like what the conflict is, who the characters are, how it's going to go, or at least how the reader thinks it's going to go, then you've done something wrong. Mm-hmm. And so those first 100 pages, which are maybe like 65 or so pages of a finished book. The 100 pages of a manuscript are about 65 pages of a finished book. It's about four chapters, give or take. And the reality is that she said that to me 11 years ago, and I still periodically, when I'm reading a book, I'll think to myself like, oh, I'm in chapter 5 and I still have a lot of questions. And it isn't a great feeling as a reader. Like you want there to be questions, but you don't want to still not know like who is the hero, who is the heroine, what is the story, what is the plot, like why can't these two idiots be together? You know, I mean, there are a lot of questions that have to be really sorted out in those first four chapters. So Carrie reads the first four chapters. When I'm stuck, I have some really good friends who I'll go to. Mm-hmm. Right now I'm working on a novella that I'm writing with a group of friends, and it's actually contemporary, and I've never written a contemporary novella. So this morning I really like woke up stuck, and Kate Claiborne, who is a good friend, is just an early riser, and I texted her and like she helped me sort out why I was stuck, which, you know, is great. I think writing is such a solitary profession and it's such a solitary experience that you really do need people who you can trust to, even if they don't read it, just like bounce ideas off of. And with romance, you really need people who understand romance. Like I find often that if I talk to somebody, like if I talk to my husband about something that I'm stuck with, he'll often sort of say something that's completely not useful, which, I mean, I love him very much and like, thanks for trying. But the reality is like when you write genre fiction, you need people who understand the bones of the genre to help you.
Yeah.
Which is why we all need to read so much you know, whenever anybody says, well, how do you learn to write a romance? Like, first and foremost, you have to have read the genre, a lot of it, to be able to understand the beats of it. So
yeah, because it's like you get a sense of it, you get a sense of the writing, so then you get the sense of the person's, where they're coming from, you know, of how they build the genre, how they and that can be really helpful.
So. Yeah.
Let's talk about the Byrne novel Bastards. You mentioned the idea of the ice, a smuggling, you know, way. What was the other, was there any other source of inspiration, or was just that idea and just evolve into?
I have been writing the same world of characters. So I've written multiple series and multiple collections of characters over the last 10 years, but I've been writing all kind of in the same world. They all overlap. If you've read all of my books, the experience of reading new books will be, I think, more enjoyable, because you'll see there are a lot of like Easter eggs and characters who come back and characters who are mentioned. So in the last series, Scandal and Scoundrel, I had a heroine in the last book, in the final book, who had gone away, who had escaped a kind of bad relationship, and like a relationship that just wasn't healthy and wasn't of its time, like wasn't grown up enough. And she had left and gone to America, where she had met a man and started, and she'd essentially become a tavern owner, like started a group of taverns. And then she decides she wants to come back to England and open a tavern in Covent Garden, near the theaters of Covent Garden. But she can't do that if she's married, and she happens to be married. So she asks for a divorce, because her husband and she had a terrible relationship, and she wants to live her life. And then that book is The Day of the Duchess, and it's actually a lost love regained book. They end up together at the end of the book, the husband and she. But she does own a tavern. She owns this tavern in Covent Garden. And I started really doing a lot of research, going back to that, on Covent Garden, which is really, if you've been to London, it's a gorgeous, gorgeous area of London. That's, you know, kind of exactly the kind, it's really cinematic and beautiful. But in the 1820s and 30s, I mean, and long after, it was not a great area. It was filled with, it had, you know, massive amounts of poverty. It was a place where the working poor kind of really had, really struggled to gain a foothold in London, in the world of London. And I got really interested in the people who built the city rather than the people who owned it. And I think at the same time, you know, it was right after the election, and I was tired of billionaires. Like, suddenly we had like a face to put with a billionaire, a real face to put with a billionaire, and it wasn't a great face. And I didn't want to write like entitled rich white men anymore. So I ended up writing rich white men who are not entitled. So I ended up writing heroes who, you know, obviously are all very well off and, you know, able to afford whatever they want, and made their money through, you know, possibly unsavory means, but ultimately with a goal of building a city that was good for everyone, not just for the wealthy.
Yeah.
Not so just for the aristocracy. And so that's how the Bare Knuckle Bastards was born. I knew I wanted to write heroes who, I wanted to write a family of kids who literally came from the gutter.
I love it. And I love the fact that those are the heroes, and then we have a member of the ton, quote unquote, serve as a villain of most of the book. So
yeah,
it's important to showcase the entitled, you know, rich white men.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I think, you know, Ewan, the villain of the first two books, is the hero of the third. And one of the things that he has to wrestle with in his book, in Daring and the Duke, is this idea of power, of what gives you power, and how power is wielded, and what kind of power we really are, what we are really asking for when we're asking for power. And so for him, you know, he was born, his father, so the three heroes of the series are all half brothers. They're all linked. They're all bastard children to a duke, in the first one, the hero's mother in the first one was a servant who got pregnant by the duke. In the second one, she was, no, I'm drawing a blank, but they are all, there's a servant, there's a woman who grew up on the estate.
Yeah.
And then there is his mistress.
Yeah.
And the mistress gets pregnant. In the setup of the third hero is that his mother got pregnant, and the Duke didn't want her to have a child, and so he exiled her. And she ended up in Covent Garden as a sex worker, working in a brothel. And so he was born in a brothel, and grew up, you know, the first 10 years of his life, he lived in this poverty, in this like kind of this difficult world. And then his father comes and brings the conceit of the series is that the father brings all three of the boys back to his estate because he's never had an heir. And he makes them compete kind of like Hunger Games style to inherit a dukedom. And Ewan inherits the dukedom. He wins the competition and he becomes the duke. And the other characters all run. And so he's not an aristocrat. He's stolen a title. And that in itself, you know, is the threat for a couple, like that's conflict in several of the books. And then ultimately he has to come to terms with what he's done. And what he's stolen from the other people, the other kids that he's been interacting with, what he stole from the girl who he, you know, his first love and only love. And I think, yeah, the entire series, because romance iterates on society so much, the entire series is kind of like a meditation on privilege and power and, yeah, just kind of money and the way that we laud certain things over others, and like the difference between nobility, capital N, and nobility, lowercase n.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was a fascinating conversation about power, patriarchy, just looking at it from a sense of like, you know, an entitled rich white man trying to, you know, put all these kids like, I'm going to save you, the white savior, and yet I'm going to battle it out. I'm going to be, you know, this place. And then.
Yeah. I mean, and certainly in terms of gendered politics, all of the books sort of tackle that too. You know, what is it to have power as a man versus what is it to have power as a woman? How does that power change? Like, how do women wield a different kind of power? Like what does domestic power look like? What is the power of domestic power or the value of domestic power? But both Hattie, the heroine of Brazen and the Beast, and Grace, the heroine of Daring and the Duke, they have jobs. You know, these are women who have power and wield power in multiple ways.
Yeah.
So.
Let's talk about Grace. So Grace is in charge of her business. She's been a fighter. She's the queen of Covent Garden. You know, she's a strong character. How much fun was it to write her as a central heroine in her story?
I mean, I've loved Grace from the very start. The first line that she speaks, I mean, I guess it's not the first line, but it's the first, it's like really her introduction to readers is in Wicked in the Wallflower. And she has these two brothers and they're idiots. And I think the line is like, you fucking imbeciles. Like, and that's like her first introduction to the reader. And so for two books, I've really written a character who had, who was smarter than everyone else, who was more evolved than everyone else in the books. She always, Grace has always been one step ahead. She's always known exactly what the game was, long before everyone else figured out the game. And I think she is, I've always written sort of smart, savvy heroines, but for me, Grace really is probably the most savvy and the most powerful of all of my heroines. And largely that's because she is already at the start of the book, centered in her dominion, right? Mm-hmm. Like she knows her kingdom and she knows the power she has in it. Mm-hmm. And I think for Grace, the lesson that she has to learn over the course of the book is how to share it, mm-hmm. how to give parts of herself up mm-hmm. without losing that power. And she has to come, and that's really difficult for a woman who, you know, is running a business that is for women at a time when the circle was closing and Victorian England was coming for women of all levels, the great irony of Victorian England is that there was a woman on the throne and women's rights were under attack almost from the jump in a way that they weren't as much during the Regency. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, that's fascinating.
That sort of betrayal, I feel like that too felt like very, I mean, now I'm saying it out loud, I'm realizing like my sort of anger, the way that I felt after the election, like that sort of 53% of white ladies like voted against the interests of women, mm-hmm. right? And voted against the interests of other marginalized groups. And I felt really betrayed by that, even mm-hmm. though it's one of those moments where you feel betrayed, but you're not surprised.
Yeah.
And I think the betrayal of Queen Victoria is on the page here.
Yeah.
Even though it's not, I mean, this is not a book about Queen Victoria, but.
Yeah, but it is, it's like the rates, like the expectations, like there was stuff that were happening. You started noticing her business was getting closer and closer, like to be shut down for reasons that are outside of her control, because entitled white men were like, women should not have the power. Women should not have
right.
the power. So.
Yeah. I mean, things like, I realized when I was writing this book, prostitution, sex work was not illegal before Victoria mm-hmm. ascended to the throne. Mm-hmm. And so sex workers were in a position to be able to be more protected. I mean, obviously,
yeah,
sex work is complicated, and a lot of, you know, women who become sex workers because they have no other choice have a different kind of experience with sex work than women who choose sex work as a career. Right. Mm-hmm. But when sex work is legal, protection comes with legality, mm-hmm. right. In many instances. And that was happening in England until, sex work was criminalized. And then, you know, prostitutes had to hide, mm-hmm. like women who were sex workers had to hide. Yeah. And we see that still today that, yeah. you know, the, I don't know, decriminalized sex work. I don't know what else to say, but.
Yeah. So let's talk about your Girlian series. What can we expect from your new series?
Sure. Hell's Bells is coming. It's four books. It's already, the series arc is already set out. It is a Victorian era girl gang. They're essentially fixers. Mm-hmm. So if you really like Scandal, that kind of thing, where things happen and they happen to women. I'm always really, and I mean, it comes as no surprise to most people that I'm really interested in the way the world interacts with women, mm-hmm. And with womanhood of all kinds. And when I say women, I mean white women, women of color, trans women, all women. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really interested in in always sort of unpacking gender and patriarchy and the way that it functions. And so in this book, I think what you'll find is kind of a really fun, exciting kind of girl gang of a gang of women who will not stand for it. If you have been wrong, they are there with you. And I mean, who among us hasn't wanted that in their life, you know? And so there are a lot of fun things. Also, you know, I'm known for cinematic kind of set pieces. So, you know, there are underground tunnels and like secret rooms and, you know, networks of spies and kind of all sorts of things that will kind of be rooms of requirement for the books. And I'm really, really excited. The heroes are all, several of them are working class. And the first hero and heroine, it's not public yet who they are, but you've met them before.
Ooh, I can't wait.
Yeah.
You probably have to wait a year or so.
I know. I'm sorry. It's not written yet. So. I'm working on it, but it's not there yet.
So now let's get to a round of book recommendations. It's an opportunity to share with our audience what they should read next. So who are your favorite authors?
Oh, that is a hard question. There are so many. So I'm just going to talk a little. I'm going to talk about like kind of a broad swath of authors because I read so widely in romance. And this is a really, you know, I'm in quarantine. I'm on day, you know, 85, I think, of quarantine. So for me, romance has really been a balm. So I've been reading a lot. So I would start with, if you love historicals, you cannot go wrong with Joanna Shoup.
Yeah.
Who is writing Gilded Age New York stories right now, which are totally amazing. I said yesterday to someone, I think Joanna is the best historical writer writing today. Mm-hmm. So do not sleep on her. I know a lot of historical readers tend toward believing that they, you know, they don't want to read outside of England. Read outside of England. Also, Joanna wrote a Regency series first. So, but my favorite thing she's ever written is coming out June 30th. So, but it's a third book in a series. So start at the beginning of that series, with The Rogue of Fifth Avenue is the first book in that series. But Prince of Broadway is great. It's about rival casino owners and a woman who wants to run a casino. And the new book is called The Devil of Downtown and it is stunning. Anyway, so Joanna, my closest friend in the world is Sophie Jordan. So I always have to shout out her books because I loved Sophie before I loved Sophie. Mm-hmm. I love Sophie as a writer before I love Sophie as a person. But her most recent book, The Virgin and the Rogue, is perfect for people who love those old school romances that I talked about at the beginning of the podcast. The Virgin and the Rogue is an aphrodisiac story. The heroine has cramps. I mean, I love where romance is going now, like kind of facing issues that women face head on. You never read about cramps before. Mm-hmm. So the heroine has cramps and her sister is like a botanist and she makes her this like tincture and she drinks it. And then her cramps go away, but she also becomes fully like sex crazed and there's a rogue in the house, but it's really deftly managed in terms of consent, and it's just terrific and really, really sexy. The book that I just read this week that I totally adored was Kennedy Ryan's Queen Move, which is, I really love the story of Daring and the Duke is childhood love to adult love, like star-crossed lovers, fated mates kind of thing. And that's what Queen Move is too. Kennedy writes these like epic kind of soap opera-y contemporaries. This is a hero and a heroine in the South who were next door neighbors, like best friends from birth. And then his parents get a divorce and his mother takes him away. And it skips forward. Kennedy paints this beautiful, lush picture of a childhood love, like coming to be. You know, they're each other's first kiss, and then they are separated and they go their separate ways and live their separate lives and then come back together in this really like emotional, romantic, intense kind of way. And then on top of it, the heroine is such a badass. Talk about, I love heroines who have careers, and she's a political operative. So it's just great. It's a great book for 2020. Kennedy doesn't shy away from issues. Like, it's just, it's a perfect romance novel. Adriana Herrera, actually my favorite thing. I love Adriana's books. I love everything Adriana has ever written. I think she's a glorious writer. But my favorite book of hers recently is her Christmas novella called Mangoes and Mistletoe. and it's just perfect. And if you love a novella, I'm somebody who loves like a Christmas novella in July. So yeah, I'm so for it. And you absolutely should check that out. It is about, it's a food romance. Food is my love language. Don't sleep on Adriana. Alexis Daria has a book coming out at the beginning of August called You Had Me at Hola, which is a Netflix. It's basically like a telenovela star. Like there's a, it's like a celebrity romance. I also love a celebrity romance. I love any romance where like identity is really unpacked, and celebrity romances get to do that. And nobody does that better than Alexis. Her first series, which was, I think, called the Dance Off series. Like it was about a TV, like a reality TV dance show, dance competition, like, what's it called?
Dancing with the Stars.
Thank you. And so like, so she really unpacks like celebrity and perception and the way the world looks at you. And then she's doing it again here. There's like a telenovela on like a Netflix style streaming service that has become, it's just like blown the doors off. It's like, you know, one of the biggest things that everybody's watching on Netflix. And, you know, it's two co-stars, like one who's a little washed up and the other who like, is sort of a new ingenue, and they're sort of trying to figure out how to manipulate. They're being, essentially they're falling in love, but there's like a kind of manipulation with the press and with the show. And again, there's like a kind of public private conversation that's being had in this book. Alexis is so talented. You can't go wrong with any of her books. And then I'm sort of obsessed right now with contemporaries, with Harlequin like Desires, because they're so quick. And you can read one in 2 hours right before bed, and they're just joyful and magnificent. And Naima Simone wrote a series about a Chicago blackout. I think it's called the Blackout Billionaire series. But essentially it starts with all three couples. There's a blackout in Chicago, and all three, it's three books, and all three couples, like there's forced proximity. Like one of them is trapped in like a high rise apartment building during a blackout, and they like fall in love. And one is like brother's best friend, and one is boss secretary. And I mean, they're all just delicious. So I don't know. That's what, six or seven off the top of my head.
Thank you, Sarah.
So yeah. I'm always happy to talk about romance novels because they bring such joy. So
where can you find me online?
You can find me on Twitter, where I'm very angry all the time, at Sarah McLean. You can find me, I don't use Facebook very much. I have a Facebook group that is really like a romance novel reading group. So I'm there, but it's not really me. It's lots of people now. It was me in the beginning, and now it's 8,000 romance readers who just talk about books all the time. So if that's something that you're into, you can find that at facebook.com/groups/OSRBC, or if you just search OSRBC, which originally stood for Old School Romance Book Club, but that's gone now. We're rebranded. And then you can find me at Fated Mates, fatedmates.net. Or wherever you listen to podcasts. You clearly are listening to this podcast, so you can find us here. And that is weekly. And then I'm on Instagram kind of obsessively. So that's probably the place where you can most find me. And I'm Sarah McLean there as well.
I love it. Thank you, Sarah, for being in the show.
Thank you so much for having me. This is so exciting.
If you enjoyed this podcast, feel free to share with friends, subscribe, or rate and review the show. This is the easiest way to support this podcast. Want to join a romance loving community? Want weekly book recommendations, monthly author Q&As, and book recommendation meetups? Make new friends? Then join our Patreon community. To sign up, please follow the links in the show notes. What to Read Next podcast is part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Find more podcasts to love on frolic.media/podcast. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.
Are you an author, publisher, or book-related business looking to reach passionate readers? What to Read Next podcast is a perfect place to connect with an engaged audience of romance and mystery lovers who are always on the hunt for their next great read. Now, we're offering sponsorship opportunities. Whether you're launching a new book, promoting an upcoming release, showcasing a bookish product or services, we can help you get the word out. Let's work together to bring your books or businesses to readers who are ready to discover something new. Please visit whatyourreadnextblog.com/sponsorships to learn more or reach out to chat about the perfect sponsorship or package for you. Thank you much for listening. Your next great reader is waiting for you.